Broadcasted live. Catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.
Well, thank you so much for staying with us as we celebrate the results of the Matric 2024 cohort. A lot is happening around the world that I think we need to pay attention to, and it's around the Middle East and lots of movement. You know that Biden is about to leave, Trump is about to step in next week, in fact, as the President of the United States, and he has said a lot of things in relation to what is happening in Gaza. I just wanted some clarity on that and what to read into the movements that we've been seeing over the past 24 hours. The Director of Israel Committee Against House Demolitions, Professor Jeff Harper, we've spoken to him before. He's back again on the line with us. A very good evening to you from our side, and thank you so much for joining us again, Professor Harper.
Good to be back with you.
A lot has happened. I mean, it's some of it hearsay, negotiations happening quite, we say that they're saying that they're quite intense. What are you making of the promises of a ceasefire? Are you optimistic?
No, I think it'll happen. I don't think there's a question about it. Because Trump gave an order to Netanyahu that he does not want this to go on. He wants this to be over in Gaza before he's inaugurated next week.
Yeah.
So Netanyahu has his marching orders. He didn't want to do it. He's been delaying all this time for his own personal and political reasons. But, you know, when Trump gives him an order, he has to do it. And so I think this is going to happen.
What are we then going to read into Biden's presiding over all of this? If Trump can give an order and Netanyahu listens, then, you know, then it raises all sorts of questions about what Biden has been doing all this time.
Well, that's right. I think there's two issues here. One is, you know, the whole the fake, unfortunately, this fake idea of a rules-based international order that Biden is always talking about, that international law matters, treaties matter, alliances matter, human rights matter, you know, all justice and all these things, you know. And in fact, I think Biden has as much plugged into the transactional world of Trump, you know, as Trump had. And this is something we have to really begin to look at and use this idea of transactionalism. In transactionalism, everything's a deal. You know, Trump wrote his book, The Art of the Deal. There's no values. There's no international law. There's no justice. There's no concern for anybody except your own self-interest. And so everything is winning and losing and power and being at the table. Well, in that transactional world, Israel's at the table. You know, it has its military, it has its technologies, it has its Jewish voters in the United States that are very important, not to mention the Christian Zionists. It's got a good control over this part of the world. It has as allies a lot of the Sunni Arab countries here. And so, you know, so it's at the table. Whereas the Palestinians in this transactional world of wheeling and dealing have nothing to offer. What do they have? They have nothing. They have no resources. They have no money. They have no political power. They have no territory. They have no allies, basically, including the Arab governments. And so I think that's the problem here. When you deal with a transactional world, ideas of justice really just fly out the window. And the other thing I just mentioned really, really quickly is that, you know, the Democratic Party supports Israel as much as the Republicans do.
Well,
and so Biden was limited in terms of how critical and how much pressure he could put on Israel because Congress wouldn't support it. Trump doesn't have that problem. Trump controls the Senate. He controls the House. And he can call Netanyahu any bad word he wants. He can pressure Israel. He can do anything he wants to in a way that Biden couldn't. And I think that's why he has that clout over Netanyahu.
Except that Biden used his wallet very, very well. I mean, he's just gifted Netanyahu, was it $8 billion last week, you know, worth of arms? And that was his parting gift, I'd say.
Well, that's right. And, you know, the Democrats have always been worse on the Palestine issue than the Republicans, actually. Yeah, Republicans have always been into oil and big business and things like that. So they've been closer to the Arab world. George Bush, the father, not to mention Eisenhower, were very hard on Israel in their day. But the Democratic Party thinks, first of all, 80% of American Jews vote for the Democrats. So, you know, they think they can't get reelected, you see, unless they support Israel in this uncritical way, even though they know better. And so the problem really is that Israel's become a kind of a domestic American issue rather than an international foreign issue in its own right.
How will history judge Biden on all of this?
I think Biden will be judged terribly. I think he's already being judged terribly. There was already, interviews on 60 Minutes with members of the State Department that resigned in protest over his ignoring human rights, violating international law, and really betraying all the ideals, you know, that he claims the rules-based international order. I think he's already being judged harshly. And, you know, the problem is that, you know, before Trump's first term, I mean, there's always transactionalism in foreign affairs, of course. Mm. But there was also strategy, and there were also alliances, and there were, you know, there were things like that. Trump threw that all out for deals that are just self-serving deals. And Biden continued that. And I think Biden is going to be condemned for not reasserting really a value-based foreign policy, kind of a policy.
So let's talk a little bit about the deal itself and what it is that they're managing to agree on. I don't know if we all know the details, but one of the things that we know is that, of course, it's about the hostages, releases of hostages on both sides, or prisoners on the other side and hostages on the other. But Hamas has got a tiny little problem. They're not telling us how many of the hostages are alive or not. And they don't actually have all of them themselves, do they?
No, I'm not sure if they are going to be able to find them all even.
Yeah.
I mean, don't forget, they've been going through 15 months of intensive warfare. And I don't know. Yeah, that's hard to know. But, you know, again, it's a deal. I mean, that just to show you, and everybody in the Israeli news is talking about this, including the military, it's exactly the same agreement that Biden brokered with Netanyahu and Hamas last May, into August. It's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it shows that it's simply a matter, the hostages don't matter. Palestinians certainly don't matter. The genocide, that doesn't bother Israel. What matters is Netanyahu's personal political future. He doesn't want to lose his coalition because the right wing, Ben Gvir and Smotrich and his right wing coalition, are going to vote against this agreement. And so he didn't want to get into all those waters. And so he's been putting off as not only Israeli soldiers and hostages, but thousands of Palestinians are dying. And for nothing, for an agreement that he could have come to 6 months ago if he had just thought about the issue itself and cared about the people rather than about himself. That's what happens when you get a narcissistic prime minister who works for a narcissistic president.
So in your view, and it's probably a tough one, when Hamas was going into this operation,
right,
with a leader like Netanyahu, who we knew before this, you know, the kind of character he is and what kind of a right-wing government he presides over, did they calculate everything properly, in your view? Did Hamas calculate this move properly?
I don't think so. I mean, I have no idea, really. I'm not in the Hamas inner circles. I think there's two things. I don't think they calculated that that well. I didn't think they expected this total response of Israel that happened. And I think they would have expected more support from the international community. Mm. At the same time, I'm not sure if they actually thought they were going to succeed. I think in many ways, they planned all kinds of military operations. This one happened to succeed because of all kinds of failures within the Israeli military and security establishment.
Yes.
So it was also kind of a combination of all kinds of circumstances that allowed it to happen. So I think you had those two things. You're right. You know, one is they didn't expect that reaction. And second of all, the attack was much more successful than they expected it to be in that sense. And that's, and Yeah, and they fell into that situation.
Have we dealt enough, and maybe this will happen post the war, at looking at those leakages, which I would consider to be leakages? I'm not sure they were luck. I think there was, you know, infiltration of sorts within the intelligence operations in Israel. Something must have happened there to allow this to happen. I'm not sure we've even started looking at that.
No, and there'll be an investigation. Netanyahu is trying to prevent, actually.
Yeah.
No, there's a lot of things. We don't really have time to get into all of that. But one thing I do want to emphasize, just talking, going back for a second about Hamas, and that is that we have to look at Hamas's operations. And no matter if you know, they do terrible things on the way, like many resistance movements do, it is a resistance movement. It can't simply dismissed as terrorism.
Yeah.
And I think in resistance, you know, that's the problem you have. You know, resistance is resistance. You're living for 18 years under a siege. You're living for 70-some years under colonial occupation. Your people have been expelled. They've been killed. The houses demolished. Everything going on. This isn't the first time Gaza was attacked by a major military power. And so you have to you don't have the luxury to sit back and say, well, when is the best time to resist and how much resistance should I do? You know, you've got to resist and, you know, take the consequences in some way. But that's part of the struggle. That's why it's called a struggle.
Yeah. My last question is obviously, you know, this deal being on the table and everybody agreeing to it. I'm nervous whether, you know, Hamas will be able to bring those bodies to the fore. And then what happens if they can't?
No, I think they will. I think in the end they'll be able to do that. I don't think that's really the problem. The issue is I think it's going to work out from that point of view. Don't forget there's going to be more than probably around 1,000 Palestinian political prisoners released as well.
Yeah.
So there is a certain achievement, with all the devastation. So it's hard to give grades to Hamas, you know, in terms of how much support they really have from the Palestinians in Gaza and if this is worth it, the destruction and the death and so on. Mm. But at the same time, I guess that, you know, again, your calculations as a resistance group that has no other choice but to resist. I mean, Israel is not going to deal with the Palestinian issue of rights and a state and national rights and so on. It's not going to do that. And so resistance is all they have left. But I think this deal will go through because I think Hamas needs it. I think the Arab governments are pushing them as well. And certainly Netanyahu needs it. And so Israel's been much more flexible, I think, than people expected because of that. So I am optimistic for all the wrong reasons why this is going to work.
So what does a post-war Palestine look like? I mean, I know for one, we can at least say most people in the world are now calling it Palestine, which was not before the 7th October. But what does it look like?
It looks like apartheid, maybe more violent than the apartheid you had, but it is apartheid. And this is exactly the point of the Gaza operation. It was to eliminate the last vestiges of resistance the Palestinians had, which is Hamas in a major way. But don't forget, there's also major military operations going on in the northern West Bank as well.
Yeah.
Plus the settlers and the army being released to drive Palestinians out of their villages in the West Bank. So where Israel is preparing for, talk about transactionalism, is going back to Trump's deal of the century. Mm. It's a deal. And the deal is Israel gets all of Palestine. Mm. From the river to the sea, that becomes Israel. All the settlements remain. Jerusalem remains Israeli and so on. Palestinians get a state like Transkei, you know, a fakey state, but they'll call it a state, and relying on the fact that nobody looks at the map. So two states, it sounds good. If one state is 90% of the country and the other state is non-viable on 10%, nobody knows that because most people just hear two states and then normalize with Saudi Arabia and the rest of the Arab world. And that's how you luckily didn't get to that. The South African apartheid government was never able to normalize its apartheid regime. It could never do that. Israel is capable of doing that because it has American support and it has support in Europe and other places as well. And that's really the fear in this transactional thing of deals, that the Arab governments will sell out the Palestinians. Israel will, you know, doesn't care about them and just wants the country. And the United States under Trump, like Biden, you know, doesn't really care about international law or laws against apartheid. There are international laws against apartheid. So all the, in a way, all the values that you enjoyed, the fact that the world was against apartheid and there was a BDS and there, you know, you had the support that caused the South African regime to collapse and your military resistance was seen as legitimate, that's all missing for the Palestinians. And so I think we're going to get a new apartheid regime, apartheid exactly in the sense of South Africa, Palestinians locked into a non-viable, non-sovereign mini state on three or four little enclaves, and that's it. And that's normalized. And normalization is the end. It's very, there's not much political space for resistance and struggle after normalization. And so, that's the challenge we face, I think.
And so finally, this is a really final question. What then will be his influence over what's happening in Syria? This is Trump I'm talking about.
Yeah, I don't think Trump's interested in Syria. Yeah, Trump is an isolationist. And I think, in fact, he's moving to normalization, not because he really cares about Israel. I think he hates Netanyahu. And he has a good streak of anti-Semitism to him, Trump. He doesn't really care. He just wants to get this off his plate because his focus is on America first. And he wants to get out of Ukraine. He wants to get out of Palestine, all this other stuff. So I don't think he's going to get that involved with Syria. So as long as this new Syrian regime manages to kind of put things together in a fairly representative way and not be too repressive, and the Europeans will work more with them, I don't think Trump is going to really intervene in the Syrian issue.
Well, I really appreciate you giving us that insight. Director of Israel Committee Against Home Demolitions, Professor Jeff Harper, on the line with us in the Middle East, just giving us his take on what is likely to happen in the next couple of days. In fact, maybe hours, dare we say. Maybe a deal is finally on the table.
If you missed it live, catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.